Well, I have a title for my talk tonight. Form is an F word, or Zen's favorite four-letter word. And I want to start by saying I have such deep love and respect for form. And I want to talk about how I have practiced with form throughout my training. And also, you know, some of the teachings about why we do what we do. People, I think the Western mind comes up against Zen forms and says, what? Because, we inherited these forms. The vast majority of the forms we practice here at Zen Center and that are practiced at Tassajara and San Francisco Zen Center are adaptations, really, from what the Japanese masters brought here. And, you know, every tradition has forms. Catholicism is, you know, Maizumi Roshi used to say that Zen was the closest to Catholicism in terms of Western religions, because Catholicism is so form-oriented, so ritual-oriented. And I think that's right. I think there's a lot of similarity. I'm like to say I'm Catholic on my parents' side, so I speak with authority on this matter. That Catholicism, you know, brings that. And it was a great comfort to me, actually, as a child. I loved the forms of the Catholic Church. The vestments, the incense, the processions and the recessions and, just really impressive stuff. And I am very moved by, sort of religious choreography, let's say. So I got, so I've been very interested in this subject matter, but I was also a while ago read a book by a Tibetan practitioner named Ken MacLeod. He's a teacher, I believe. And he wrote a book, An Arrow to the Heart. It's a lovely book. It's very poetic, really a fun read, and also I found it very moving, about the Heart Sutra. And here's what he said are the three realities of ritual. And this really moved me. Moved me so much that several years later I quoted it to Kokyo. So I really remembered this out of that book. He says, you teach what you know, but for others it's just dogma. You create a ritual to celebrate your joy, but for others it's just an empty form. You adopt disciplines to support your practice, but for others they're just rules. And I think that's right. I mean, this struck me as very true. That, you know, when we bring our whole body and mind to something, it's fresh and new every time. Because our bodies and minds are fresh and new in every moment, actually, if we can bring ourselves in that way. But when we don't do that and we just, you know, bow or we just do our forms thoughtlessly, because we've memorized them, we do them by rote, essentially, then yeah, they become empty. Just why are we bothering to do it? I mean, sometimes I think in Zen, we've created so many forms, we've paralyzed ourselves. I mean, nobody can do it perfectly, right? So, I mean, there are hundreds of forms. So I think, Ken has a great answer for this, Ken MacLeod, in his book. He says simply, when you're hungry, eat, and when you're full, stop. And that's his answer to form, and to form becoming not so meaningful. In other words, it's your body. It's about your body and mind. It's not about an empty form that somebody else created, you know, centuries ago, and now you're reenacting in some way or imitating in some way. That bow that you do is your bow. It's only your body can do that bow. Only your mind in that moment uniquely can do that bow. No Zen master, no matter how great, can do your bow. Because they don't have your body and mind. So I feel, I think there's some form words in our language that frighten us. In my mind, we think of these words as danger and opportunity. Danger and opportunity contained in them. One of them is uniform. uniform. So do you just want us all to be the same? Do we all just have to look alike? And the Americans go, what? You know, I can't do that. That's not us. You know, that's not who we are, the rugged individualists. You know, I think there is something about a certain uniformity in form. It's very beautiful to see people moving together, breathing together, moving as one body. I mean, I've practiced in sanghas where, you know, for example, someone could be still seated after zazen, struggling with a leg or something that's asleep, they can't move, and the whole sangha just begins walking around them. And that's always, you know, puts in my body a sort of uneasiness, like, really? Here, we wait. We wait until everyone's standing and everyone can move together. And I find a lot of beauty in that. That's a sort of, you know, a sort of caring for each other that we do. And we can do that because we're engaged in shared forms. So we know that if someone doesn't get up after zazen and we're all standing, we know there's some difficulty or something that needs support there. And we can wait or we can help and until everyone is one body standing. Until the next movement occurs. And I think that's you feel that in your body. I do. I feel it in my body when everyone waits or everyone moves together. It's very beautiful. And I think, you know, the body craves beauty. We crave beauty. And not in a negative sense of craving, but it's something we need. You know, human beings forever have created beauty, you know, wherever they were. The petroglyphs on the rocks. I mean, you know, people have been creating beauty everywhere. Not because it's some craving that we're, you know, striving for, but because it's like food. I feel it's like food. So we seek it and we create it. And I think form is like that. And if we are uniform, then it's something that we're bringing forth together. It's a beautiful expression of our practice that we're bringing forth together. And for me, that's very moving and very inspiring. And Suzuki Roshi talked about this aspect of form. He, just to paraphrase, I don't have the exact quote, but, you know, that when everyone is practicing in the same way, sort of, that he could see individuality against the palette of similarity, right? So without everybody running around doing something different, suddenly you can really see. I mean, have you noticed during Sesshin that you can hear the foot drop and know who it is, right? You're looking at the wall, there's 30 people in the room, but you know who just came in because your body and mind are quiet and you're listening in a new way and you're able to distinguish individual differences, even in footfall. That's how subtle that attention can become. And I think that's a fruit of form. If we didn't have our shared forms, we wouldn't be able to distinguish those fine, nuanced patterns or individual differences. My teacher, my late teacher, Darlene, talked about that as the shimmering uniqueness of every individual. And of everything, all phenomena. And that shimmering uniqueness shows its face in the field of emptiness, which is the field we are embodying when we practice together our forms, mutual forms, or shared forms. So I think it creates a sort of freedom in practice, a sort of restfulness, in a sense. Like I don't have to rethink it all the time. I just kind of know what to do. I think there's another word, though, and this is the word that leads me into the F-word nature of form, and the word is conform. Conform. So this, to me, speaks of rules, of resignation, of a yes and no answer, of a right and wrong approach, right? This is the right form, the way we do it here. And that form they do over there, that's the wrong form. Okay, so here we're putting a moral overlay on form or on practice, let's say. It's not just what it is, it's also good or bad. So we're looking for some kind of perfection here. We're asking people to learn by rote some rules. How many times do you ring the bell here? How many times do you ring it there? How loud? How soft? Which bell? I was at a session recently where I was the Eno, and I was working with a person who was in charge of the Doan Rio, who had never done that job, and she was scared to death that she was, you know, and we had all new people to each other at the session, so we had no idea who knew what. I mean, and I was brand new to the teacher, so I had no idea what her expectations were. So, you know, I made a decision going in that I was not going to chase every bell to make it somehow fit some standard, because I would spend my entire 7 days doing that. And why? So I sat back, and by the way, I'm a form freak. So I could easily be the form cup. It's like away I go, okay? So this would not be a big stretch for me to be the form cup. So I said, no, I'm not going to be the cup. I'm going to sit quietly and watch what unfolds here. And what unfolded was that although the bells were not all the same, they were not uniform, although they, you know, some people rang the bell when the teacher bowed to the room, some people rang the bell when the teacher bowed to the chair, but miraculously, the teacher sat down and gave her talk every day. Everyone was present. Everyone was facing the right direction. When things needed to move, they moved. Yes, you know, people understood the bells, in other words. And the han. And what I started to pay attention to was more, what is the relationship between the person, the being, and the bell? The being and the han, right? So you could hear their relationship. There was a guy there ringing that bell, that temple bell, who has rung that temple bell for 30 years, I think. And it sounded like an old family friend. I mean, when he rang that bell, it rang from your head to your toes, and you just knew he was intimate with that bell. And then somebody else would ring it who was newer, and it would kind of clunk a few times till they got better at it, got used. Bells have a personality. You have to introduce yourself and become known to them, and they to you, and then you can they reveal themselves, and you could hear that in the bells. It's very moving. So form took on a whole new meaning to me in that sense. It was no longer about just is everybody where they need to be, and are all the bells perfect, and is there some standard, but rather what is coming forth from folks as they're expressing themselves in these forms, and is it working for the community? Is the river flowing? If the river's flowing, I'm not going to push it to try to make it something, right? That, right? So it was a huge eye-opener to me, because I have entered sanghas before and said, hey, you know, this is how it should be, or this is, you know, and I got it. That's not it. That's not it at all. It's not about conform. So form becomes an F word when we use it against beings. When we try, when we establish some for perfection or some idea, which I think is outside of practice, really has nothing to do with practice, about how everything should be. And, you know, and cause discomfort when it isn't that way. However, I do think when we practice forms, you know, the first time you ring a bell in a silent zendo, it makes you think. I mean, you have to think a little. And you go, everything sounds really loud when you're ringing it, you know. So there is a practice about form of sort of the mind coming up against it, you know, and watching your mind work with all of that. Fear of not getting it right, thinking it's perfect. Oh, I did that good. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of variations of this. And the fact of form is what helps us see all of that. We wouldn't even see it if we were all just, you know, ringing a bell our own way. But the fact that we're trying to do it in an agreed upon way lets us see, oh, look at this mind. It's insane. It's like all over the map. I can't even, I'm sweating here. You know, and never have I seen anyone punished for not doing form perfectly. But I'm sweating here. So this is mind. Right? So I get to see my mind. So all of our practice is about studying the mind, studying our own world. And so form is another way that we do that, and that's an aspect of it. I do think also, though, as a developer of groups and community, that we need to be careful about form, that it can become exclusive. We can feel like, you know, hey, we're just a little bit, you know, we're cool. We know how to do that, right? We come here, we all look good, but what about the new person who doesn't know how to do all this? Are we helping them? Are we attentive to them? Are we warmly making it okay for them to not know? I think it's so important for us as a Sangha, if we're going, since we have such strong form in this community, to be careful that we are, that we open ourselves and not have that, have form close us and make us seem rigid and inaccessible to everyone. Because ultimately, our practice is about inclusion and all beings, right? Whether they can sit like we sit, bow like we bow, stand like we stand, talk like we talk, or not. All beings. Not just all beings who wear black and can sit like a Buddha. So I think when we talk about conform, we have to be careful that we aren't just doing that to create some illusion of control that we really don't have. And we never will. It's the nature of our lives that we don't have that control. And so we create an edifice to make us think it's there, but it's not there. It's really much more fluid than that. My teacher, Tony Patchell, practiced at Green Gulch Farm for many years with Reb Anderson, and he tells a story that I love so much that speaks to this point for me. He said one day, he was frequently late for morning zazen, Tony, and apparently. And so he one day was going to the Zendo, and he was late, and so everybody was already in there. And he's calmly, Tony's a very calm guy, calmly walking to the Zendo, and Reb approached him and said, "Hey, Tony, I noticed that you're often late for zazen in the morning. What's going on?" And Tony said, "Well, you know, Reb, I lay in my bed and I think, well, do I want to go or do I not want to go? You know, do I really want to do that?" He goes, "I hear the bell and I think, hmm." And Reb said, "I had no idea you were engaged in such deep practice. I bow to your practice." Okay? So here's an understanding of form that is beyond form. It's beyond conformity. It's beyond uniformity. It's about this person, this being, and his practice, his mind, his grappling with the sound of the bell. His grappling with the sound of the bell is different from my grappling with the sound of the bell. Darlene, his wife, frequently said she'd be up, you know, she'd hear the bell and she'd wait about 10 and then she'd be running to the Zendo, tying her robes, you know, as she's flying down the path, right? He's back there turning in the bed going, hmm. Both beautiful practices. Both working with form as a process of looking at their own intention, their own deep, their own deep minds, but just in different ways, a shimmering uniqueness. There it is, Darlene and Tony, each completely different, but working with the same form and the same practice, but it's showing up very differently in each of them. So I think there's another word which maybe feels to me like what we want from form. So I think sometimes when these forms are not easy, they've been for me very physically difficult, actually very, very physically challenging and difficult over the years of my practice. And I think sometimes I have wanted something back for that. You know? Like I'm in all this frickin' pain. I mean, what's in it? You know? So there's this word transform. And I think that's what sometimes I want from form. I want it to transform me. I want it to transform my life and my world. And really it does, because form as a practice is a way to bring a very awake presence to what we are doing. So this consciousness that we bring to form is not self-consciousness, though it sometimes feels that way. In a conforming environment, it feels self-conscious. But It's more of a present consciousness than a self consciousness. So what room, you know, you don't go into the library and yell, right? Well, I mean, you may, but you might get questioned. There's a contextual appropriateness. So we notice where we are, how we move our body in space, how we speak, how we look at others, how we engage with others. And when we are really present conscious in that way, not self-conscious, but present conscious in that way to the whole moment, this false gap between me and you can just melt. It can just fall away. Or this false space between my own body and mind. That's the most immediate way that I notice it. So I think for me, the way that form has been most, the most true word I can use to talk about form in my experience is the word deform. And that's truthfully how, what I feel form does for me. It deforms my ideas. And then they reform, but in a somewhat of a more of a looser way. They're just not quite as tight when I get up from the bow. So let me talk about a little bit about bowing, because bowing for me, it's such a physical activity, and even to this very day, I have to be extremely alert and aware in order to bow. I have a lot of physical pain, physical injuries. My balance is not that good. I have nerve spinal injuries, so I have a lot of nerve pain. Nerve pain is crazy. I mean, you know, nerve pain can be one place one second, another place another second. You don't know where it's going to be, really. So I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but I approach the bowing mat really analyzing, what can my body do today? What can this body do right now? Right now. So maybe this morning I did the 9 bows. Maybe I did the 12 bows, the 15 bows, whatever it was. But this afternoon, what is this body? Can this body do bows this afternoon? So people who work with me when I'm doshi and they're doan know that by how I put down my zagu, whether I'm going to do full standing bows or full bowing bows, full prostrations. And I use my zagu differently to indicate. Now that was something I learned from my teacher, who always did full standing bows because she was not able to go down to the floor. So she used her zagu the way I do when I'm doing full standing bows. But when I'm going to bow on the cushion, when I feel my body can do that, I put my zagu fully on the cushion and I bow on the cushion. So this is a signal to the doan. I'm actually communicating with the doan by how I place my zagu. And doans kind of have learned that. So I guess what I want to convey is that, you know, every bow is new. I can't approach any bow thoughtlessly. In the morning, 9 bows, every bow, I stand, and it's a whole new bow. And I have to assess my body in that moment of standing, assess my breath. Do I have enough breath to complete another bow? Because I've been struggling a lot this year with asthma. So do I have enough breath to complete the next bow? Is my body present enough to do this bow safely and do it to really do the bow wholly with my whole body and mind? I don't want to fake it. Excuse me, I seem to be losing my robe here today. I don't know what's happening. I don't want it on the floor. Excuse me. So bowing is not something that I've ever been able to do automatically or without complete consciousness. I have fallen over bowing when I haven't been fully present within my, you know, I haven't been fully conscious of every muscle movement, every connection of body to floor. Recently, I had neck surgery, and so now I can't use my head in bowing. Do you know how much you use your head to bow? You use your head as a pivot to bow. Most people do. And it puts a lot of strain on the neck, which I never knew until I had neck fusion. And I said, you know, I have to be able to bow after my surgery. This is like so important. And he said, you'll be able to bow, but don't use your head. And it's right. One thing you don't have to use your head for. My mother would love this. Don't use your head. But So it changed my bow again. So once again, new bow. So now I look like I'm using my head, but I'm not using my head in my bow. So that, what did that mean? That meant I had to adjust my elbows so that my elbows became the pivot for the bow. This is, seems like so like minutia, but this is my practice with form. It's very, very specific and minute in every moment. Walking, because I have such foot pain, walking. Really, I pay very close attention to walking. My teacher, Darlene, said she had such pain walking. She said, I finally figured out that walking isn't just when my foot hits the ground, but also when I pick my foot up. That's walking too. So she learned to put her mind in the foot that was up rather than the foot that was down. So the foot that was down was painful. The foot that was up was at rest. She trained her mind to go to the foot at rest. How do you learn that? You know, how do you come to that kind of detail about your walking, about your footfall, about your personal, you know, your body's movement without such careful attention to it? And that's what form is. Very careful attention to the movement of our bodies in space, our deportment with others. There is a precision to form, and precision, you know, is part of our practice. And it, I think, is what begets beauty in form when we are all precise. So this word deform is hugely valuable to me when it comes to my practice, that it deforms me constantly. And I then have to approach it with a whole new process. It just can't be the same after it's deformed. So this makes me think of the self receiving its function, constantly receiving its function in every moment, because I'm not choosing it. The bow deforms me, and then I don't know. Whatever is there for the self can come in and be received in that moment of openness that's created by the not knowing. And the not knowing arises in the practice of form, among many other ways. So if I am attentive to my bows, I see that I must remain fluid, that if I make anything at all solid, that bow will fail. I mean, I can fall, I cannot be able to get up. Literally, the bow will fail if I make anything solid. If I make my body solid, if I make my pain solid, if I make my idea about whether I can do it or not solid, right? I might think, okay, I can't do the next one. Then I do it. And when I stand up, I go, oh. Okay. So it's just always informing me. There's never just a going to sleep with this. It's a constant sort of feedback loop in form. And it just supports my practice so much. Can definitely, you know, be used in ways that isn't so supportive of practice. And that's where I started. So I'll close now with a quote from by Cobencino, who founded this practice place, and Jikoji and several other sanghas. He told a story of dropping to the floor, weeping in uncontrollable grief when, as a child, he received the news of his father's passing. So years later, as an adult, as a Zen teacher, he's telling this story about when he was a child. He just, uncontrollable grief, fell to the ground in a bow. Dropped to the floor, he said. When he rose to his feet, both he and the world seemed irrevocably changed. I think of bowing that way, he said. You go down, and when you come back up again, you're a different person. And for me, that's right. You go down, and you come back up again, and you say, who am I now? And then what's the sort of expression of who I am now? So when you come back up, you're a different person. The world has changed. When we bow, we just totally put ourselves into it. And then there's no separation between you and the three realms, between you and life, and between you and death. And that's that dropping off of the gap between what I do and what I say, or what I do and my sitting, or how I am in everyday life and how I am on the cushion, can just drop off through the practice of form. Because we really do have to give up our ideas. You know, I have to give up my idea about my body to bow. Otherwise, I would never bow in public. So it's a dropping away of ideas, and then bringing what's left fully to the physical enactment of form. So thank you very much for listening to me. I would love to hear questions or comments that you have. Edie.
Experience of facing the wall and hearing the foot falling and recognizing, oh, that's Jeff and that's me and that's Catherine and so on, but I cannot hear my own. I cannot recognize or hear my own, and I'm just wondering about that.
Well, that's probably why you can hear others. That you're not caught up in your own. Leave space to actually hear others. I mean, I get caught up in my own sounds, internal sounds, right? And then I don't even hear what's going on in the room. So what you're saying is, I'm present in the room and I'm hearing and I can identify. But what I hear you saying is, I'm sort of not caught in my own sound, my own noise. Does that fit? So I think that's beautiful. Thank you. Yes. So I lay the zagu about a foot back from the bowing mat and I stand on it. Because when you do a standing full, you're bowing at the waist, you know, almost bowing your body in half, right? And your row, this corner right here. So this is the attention, right? Falls behind you, actually. So if you put your zagu on the bowing mat and do your bow, your okesa will not fall on the zagu. It will fall on the floor. So I just bring the zagu back and stand on it, and then the okesa falls on the zagu. And also, it's very, very hard for me physically to bow on this wood, because my zagu moves. You know, I end up in pain when I bow here on the floor without a mat. So, because I'm chasing the zagu. So I'm pushing and pulling at the same time to keep the zagu in place and also get my body down. Then when I try to get my body up, which I use my hands, right, then my zagu moves and I'm stretched. So I'm still working with how to bow on this slippery floor. I've sat here 15 years, 12 years. I'm still working on how to bow on this floor. And the zagu made it kind of harder. But even on the floor, what I wanted to say is, when I am bowing on the floor, if I'm going to do standing bows, I just put the zagu down normally and then stand right on the zagu and bow on the zagu rather than behind it. Jean?
Individual internal process of oneself. And I think for me there is this other element of being informed by the response of the world to what I do. I was not too long ago at a public library and watched this event unfold. A mom was teaching about a four-ish-year-old child about entering the library. This is public space, and when we're in the library, when you cross that little line right there, from there forward, we're quiet, and you practice within, and this and that. And then, on the real entry, the child step into the room and announce
the kid after my own heart. Yeah, that's my favorite kid.
No matter what the mom will say.
Fabulous.
So almost every patron in the library turned and looked, and that child was paying attention and got the feedback from the world. And then went, oh. And you could see his posture is coming.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes. And all the more reason why I think it's so important that we not become rigid and use form as a weapon, because or look for conformity. Because, you know, that kid was beautiful in his shimmering uniqueness. You know, he got his lesson. He had the lesson fully in him. And he walked in and was himself fully in that moment. I mean, to me, that's what form brings forth. And then, yes, he gets this sort of correction from the community. And that's where we come in as a Sangha, is making sure that correction, it will happen. Because our form is a container. And anybody entering here will get that correction just by looking at us, right? So I think it's important that correction be soft and gentle and loving and not rigid and hard and you better, you know, you got to do it, you know. And I also think that sanghas can handle quite a lot of variation. I think that we can, within the context of our form, we can actually live with a certain amount of, you know, non-conformity, so to speak, and be fine. So it's fine that he walked in the library and announced himself. It might have been the bodhisattva action for half the patrons in the library who looked up and were renewed by his exuberance. You know, we don't know. Right? He just put out his complete action for the world. It's beautiful. And I hope that that's what we bring forth here, that kind of individual, you know, uniqueness in the context of you know, our shared practice. I hope we have room for both as a Sangha, for all of that as a Sangha. Thank you. It's a beautiful story. I hope he comes to practice here someday. Malcolm?
One of the things that your talk brought up for me is the place of our willingness to do it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just to do it.
Yeah.
And then to have that feedback. And not to get too caught up in whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong or
yeah.
just the right thing, but just to move and do it.
Right.
And then if it's right, great.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not, you get another chance.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so that there is that ease even with us now, which that's not the tip of the bell.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what we practice with in Zazen, you know, bringing compassion to our minds and our bodies and also to our, to the mistakes we make. I mean, I think form does show us, I mean, it does show us, oh, that didn't quite sound right, or that wasn't, the timing of that wasn't quite right, or, you know, you can kind of feel it in your body after a while. And so, yes, then you equally feel the disharmony from the quote mistake. Yet it's all part of the flow of our lives. You know, some days I wake up and my body feels strong and light and I could do anything. And this morning I woke up and my body feels clunky and heavy and I've been dropping things all day and I'm like, I'm giving a talk tonight. You know, can I do the bows? So it's, I think that's our lives. It's just to meet whatever it is. And then, meet it with everything we have. And sometimes that means that our form is impeccable, and sometimes it means that there are days when I can't remember whether I'm supposed to bow to my cushion after 22 years or not, you know. So, or I forget to do the simplest things that I've done every day for 20 plus years. So, and all of that, I would like us to be a community where all of that is just fine. Just fine. right? Because the fact is, here we are together, and that's the important thing. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I really pay attention, and I really try to do the form.
Yeah.
Because there's this beauty in putting things together, and then there's the oops moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that is bliss paying attention. Outside Zendo, I'm so busy doing my work at the shop.
Yeah.
And I'm not paying, it's not that quiet, it's very noisy, very active.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how many mistakes I made there.
Oh.
And I know I made many, many more mistakes.
Interesting.
In this noisy environment.
Mm.
Even though I tried to do a good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it made me much softer to what I used to perceive as mistakes of others because they tried their best too.
Yes.
And so that was for me the big lesson that I took from form.
Yes. That's beautiful. Exactly. It brings forth compassion and empathy. And, you know, that one that oops moment, we are all sharing that with you too. You know, we all have our oops moments all the time. And that's a shared experience too. That's part of the form. That's not separate from correct form, that oops moment. It's actually just part of the flow of perfect form. And your effort is really the important thing. That's what I loved about what you said. You know, when I'm here and when I'm at work, I try. You know, I try. And that's what it is. That's the practice of just continuing. And Malcolm, you know, yes, the mistake, and then continue. Do it again. Put it out there. Be willing. You know, there is an exposure in Zen practice. There is a sort of nakedness in Zen practice, being willing to just put yourself out there in Sangha and be seen and be known and make your mistakes publicly. Right? This is ask your hard questions to the teacher in the Zendo, right, in front of everyone. I mean, so there is a call in Zen almost for exposure in practice, and it is very deep learning. As you described. So what do you think? In the din of the noise and the movement at work, do you think people just mostly don't notice mistakes? I mean, here they're very noticeable because it's quiet and so they really stick out. But when you're in your everyday life and coming and going and people, it just kind of flows into the noise.
I think in general, the mind is more quiet. The body is more quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And so, each activity is more secular, more noticeable, more distinct.
Yes.
At work on the keyboard.
Yeah.
And phones ringing, and someone calling for me across the room.
Right.
It's harder to capture the detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's so much information coming, so much going on.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm lucky and like stops for a little fraction of a second.
Just to see what's actually happening. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We live lives that are faster than our bodies can track. And, you know, Michael Langer, when he did Darlene's funeral, he started the funeral by saying, you know, we're born, we die, and in between, what happened? And I think it's like that, like what you described. And so when we're in the Zendo and we're mindful and present, conscious, we know what happened. You know, we know where we left the umbrella, how we put our shoes, right? We know, but when we go to work, it's different. The energy is so different. So I think form is a way that our bodies learn to translate our life on the cushion to our life with the phones and the keyboards and all the things going on. To bring some, it shows us how to translate the stability. Chuck spoke to this. Where is he? Chuck spoke to this in his talk last week about getting up from Zazen and feeling very stable in walking. And I think the same thing can translate to work and to our everyday lives from our practice of Zazen and also form. So, thank you. for bringing that forth. It's a great lesson. Any other questions or comments before we end? Annette, we'll end on this one.
As always, I'm just so full, my heart is so full when you talk. It's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. What I'm appreciating, especially, is the Zen practice does this all the time, but there's this complete importance and seriousness with form that's completely lighthearted.
Right. Exactly.
And so bringing those two things together for me, I just especially been noticing lately some of the things that, after years of practice, I cannot do a chant line after line all the way through and keep my mind without saying the wrong thing. I don't think it's ever happened. And it just makes me smile. Mm-hmm. My intention is still just as full. Mm-hmm. But I go, can you?
So do you really think what you said was the wrong thing then?
It just confuses me.
Honest to goddess, you think it's the wrong thing?
I'll ask myself that. Tomorrow morning when I'm chanting the wrong thing.
You're chanting something different from what others are chanting, perhaps.
What came to mind was the quote that we have on a piece of art in our little studio from Suzuki Roshi that says, what we're doing here, that quote of what we're doing here is so important, we better not.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. That's right. Thank you, Anna. Thank you all very much. Beings are